Hello and welcome. This is Mark Weber. Thanks for being with me today. In this broadcast, I'm going to talk about some of the social economic issues that are very much in the news and on people's minds here in the United States and throughout North America and indeed around the world. As everyone knows, the economic and social political problems in our society are serious, they're grave, and they're very dismaying. They include entrenched political paralysis, economic stagnation, endemic social economic inequality, an erosion of national identity and purpose, increasing social polarization, and broad distrust of the U.S. around the world. I've been dealing with these issues and these trends at talks I've been giving in recent weeks and months, including at talks in Ottawa and Toronto in Eastern Canada just a few weeks ago, and I also spoke about this in some detail at an IHR meeting here in Orange County, Southern California, last Saturday. The meeting, by the way, was a very upbeat, successful event. We were gratified not only by the good turnout, which, in fact, there were so many people that we ran out of seating for people and some had to stand, but also we were encouraged by the larger number of younger people and of new people. In fact, over the past several years, we've held many more meetings than we ever did in the past, and this has enabled us to build up a level of fellowship and of cohesion here in Southern California that we've never had in the past. And it's reflected in the spirit and the friendly, upbeat, collegial atmosphere of the meetings that we've been holding in recent years. At this meeting, I spoke and also Paul Fromm spoke on the question of the changing face of North America and dealt with some of these larger issues. Today I'm going to focus especially on the issue of social economic inequality in American society and what that means. I'm going to talk about the issue of diversity in American society, which our political leaders tell us is a great virtue, and the larger question about of why some societies are better off than others, a question that scholars and social scientists have tried to answer for many years, and of course one that is especially much greater on people's mind today than it has been because of the serious economic problems we've been having in the United States in recent years. Just a few weeks ago, it was announced by the U.S. government that the typical American family lost nearly 40% of its wealth from 2007 to 2010 as the Great Recession reduced household net worth to a level not seen since the early 1990s. And this blow to the net worth of American families is in addition, of course, to the very high unemployment rate that has been plaguing the United States for some years. And, of course, that even in the last year and a half, in spite of all the talk of a turnaround, the economy remains very sluggish, with a high unemployment rate, a very soft housing market, and a very sluggish economy. And on top of it all, of course, is great concern that it could all fall apart again, that the United States could face another recession because of the weakness, not only in the American, but the world economic situation. One of the important aspects of all of this has been the much greater increase in economic and social inequality in American life. Just recently, a piece was issued by a man named Joseph Stiglitz, who is a professor of economics at Columbia University. In fact, he received the Nobel Prize in economics in the year 2001. And in an essay entitled The Price of Inequality and the Myth of Opportunity, Stiglitz makes the point that the American dream, that is, the American dream of everybody being able to raise themselves up through hard work, if they just apply themselves, is a myth. In fact, Stiglitz writes, there is less equality of opportunity in the United States today than there is in Europe, or indeed in any advanced industrial country for which there are data. This is one of the reasons, he goes on, that America has the highest level of inequality of any of the advanced countries, and its gap with the rest has been widening. In the so-called economic recovery of 2009-2010, the top 1% of U.S. income earners captured 93% of the income growth. And, Stiglitz goes on, America's inequality is undermining its values and identity. Two scholars who have gone into this in even greater detail are Richard Wilkinson and Kate Pickett, who are authors of a book that came out several years ago entitled The Spirit Level, Why Greater Equality Makes Societies Stronger. In the book, they point out that, as Stiglitz did, that inequality, social and economic, has been increasing in American life. And the authors of this book, The Spirit Level, warn that the consequences of that are very dangerous. And they assemble a tremendous amount of data in this book to show that there is a close correlation between levels of social economic equality in a society and the levels of prosperity, of well-being, of life expectancy, crime rates, and so forth in a society. In other words, societies in which there is a high level of social economic equality are also societies that have longer living life expectancies, higher survival rates of children. The societies are less obese. People are healthier. There's more orderliness. There's less crime. And of course, greater prosperity. And as I mentioned in this book, they assemble tremendous data to underscore the conclusions that they reach. The book points out that the levels of inequality in American society have been rising very rapidly over the past 50, 60 years. During the 1950s and 60s, the CEOs, the chief executive officers of major American companies, took home about 25 or 30 times the wages of the typical worker. But in 1980, big company CEOs took home roughly 40 times the wages of the typical worker. And by 1990, it was 100 times the wages of the typical worker. This rapid growing disparity between the very rich and the very poor has been across the board in American society. For example, the prominent sports figures in American life now make vastly more than their counterparts, that is, prominent sports figures did during the 1930s or 40s. In 1957, the outstanding baseball player Mickey Mantle earned just $60,000. I mean, even adjusted for inflation, that is far, far less than a figure in sports of his prominence would make today. In the 1940s, Clark Gable, one of the most successful and prominent Hollywood actors, earned $100,000 a picture, which would, in today's terms, would be perhaps $800,000. But nowadays, Tom Hanks, for example, makes close to $20 million per picture. And on it goes, this inequality, this gap between the very rich and the very poor has been growing across the board. As Wilkinson and Pickett point out in this book, The Spirit Level, the differences around the world in well-being, prosperity, and so forth are tremendous. And the authors of this book assemble all this data to show just how greatly different levels of community, equality, and so forth vary from country to country. But they measure all sorts of things in this book, not just income level, but things like well-being, life expectancy, crime rates, and so forth. And they show that over and over again, the countries with the highest level of happiness or well-being, life expectancy, are countries like Japan, Iceland, Switzerland, Sweden, New Zealand, Denmark, and so forth. And of course, countries in Central Africa and so forth tend to be at the very bottom of these lists of countries. The index, for example, of people who consider themselves having lives that are happy or very happy are much higher in countries like Canada, Iceland, Norway, Denmark, Sweden, Japan, and so forth than they are in others. And, as they show, there's not an absolute correlation between even the level of income in these societies. In other words, some societies that do not have a high in income are still overall happier societies, higher levels of well-being, of social stability, and so forth, than other societies. The gap in income between the richest and the poorest in society is very narrow. The narrowest countries include Japan, Finland, Norway, Sweden, Denmark, Belgium, Austria, Germany are at the top of the list for societies in which there's the least amount of gap of difference between the rich and the poor. The United States, on the other hand, is near the bottom of this listing of countries that measure the gap between the rich and the poor. The United States is down below near Portugal or the United Kingdom and much below those other countries that I mentioned. And as already mentioned, it's not just merely the relationship between social economic inequality and prosperity overall. It also, there's a close correlation between those things and the level of trust in society, the levels of mental illness in society, life expectancy, infant mortality, even obesity, that is, societies in which there's greater social economic inequality tends to have societies in which people are more overweight. Children's educational performance varies also. There's a correlation between that. Teenage births, homicides, imprisonment rates, and social mobility. Now, this is, in the United States, especially striking because that's not what American society used to be noted for. One of the most famous and perceptive looks at American society was provided in the early 19th century by the Frenchman Alexis de Tocqueville in his famous book, Democracy in America. And when he was traveling around the United States and meeting with people, both ordinary common people, but also presidents and high-ranking Americans at that time, he observed that one of the features of American life was a tremendous amount of social economic equality. He wrote in Democracy in America, "Among the new objects that attracted my attention during my stay in the United States, none struck me with greater force than the equality of conditions. I easily perceived the enormous influence that this primary fact exercises on the workings of the society." Now, things have moved tremendously far away in America from the time in the early 19th century when Alexis de Tocqueville wrote that nearly two centuries ago. De Tocqueville also mentions in his book the amazing readiness of Americans to help other people during that time. He wrote, for example, "Should some unforeseen accident occur on the public highway, people run from all sides to help the victim. Should some family fall foul of an unexpected disaster, 1,000 strangers willingly open their purses." Well, of course, that's changed also enormously in the last 2 centuries or so since Alexei de Tocqueville wrote that. Now, there are 2 big reasons why that has changed, 2 big changes in American life since those words were written in the early 19th century. First of all, American society doesn't have the same opportunity objectively that it did in the 19th century. During that time, America was still a largely undeveloped continent, and America's prosperity and its enormous expansion, especially during the 19th century and the early part of the 20th century, was due in large measure to the huge and abundant resources the United States had. Immigrants from Europe could come to the United States and obtain land and farmsteads very easily, exhaust the soil, and move on to more land because there was plenty of it in America. This was a continent with every major natural resource, huge forests, millions of acres of first-rate farmland, petroleum, gold, coal, iron ore, and other important minerals, and of course, and great harbors. And in addition to all of that, no powerful enemies to have to fight to obtain this huge amount of land and real estate here in North America. That was one of the reasons why America was able to expand very rapidly. And another significant factor, of course, was that America was founded and settled overwhelmingly by people from Europe. And because it was not easy to get to the United States, especially in the 18th and 19th centuries, or it was much more difficult than nowadays, the people who did come here tended to be much more driven, much more motivated, and generally more ambitious and more intelligent than people who have come later to immigrate to the United States in more recent decades. In recent years, American society has become vastly more diverse, to use this much-used, much-overused term. In this regard, a very interesting study was carried out recently by a Harvard political scientist named Robert Putnam. Now, Robert Putnam was already known as a political scientist, sociologist, for a book he wrote and published in the year 2000 entitled Bowling Alone. And in that book, Putnam was made the point that Americans are far less communitarian than they had been in the past. And the title of the book is a reference to the fact that there are far fewer bowling clubs or civic social organizations than there were in the 1950s and 1960s. People are much more atomized, much more individualized today than they were back in the 1950s and 60s. But more startling and with far greater implications for American society today is his more recent study, in which he shows that the more diverse a society is, the fewer people vote and volunteer, give to charity, and have much less trust in each other. In the more diverse communities, neighbors trust one another about half as much as they do in the most homogeneous and cohesive communities. Now, these findings by Robert Putnam were made public in the year 2007, and they caused a tremendous amount of discussion and controversy, but not as much as I think they deserved, because the implications are really very important. It's been very popular in the United States to speak of racial and ethnic diversity as a civic strength. And our political leaders tell us over and over that diversity socially, politically, socially, racially, ethnically makes American society stronger. In fact, in the State of the Union address by President Bill Clinton in February 1997, he claimed that diversity is our greatest strength. But the findings by Robert Putnam, made public in 2007, show precisely the opposite. The study was the largest ever on the levels of civic engagement in the United States, and it found that virtually all measures of civic health are lower in the more diverse settings. A University of Michigan political scientist said the extent of the effect of diversity is shocking, he said. Now, this study by Putnam comes at a time when the future of the American melting pot is the focus of intense political debate, from immigration to race-based admission to schools and so forth. And it poses a very major fundamental challenge to all of those who claim that diversity is a great strength. It's remarkable that how much hand-wringing Robert Putnam engaged in when he made these findings public, because he himself is a liberal academic whose findings were counter to his own values, his own notions of what society should be like. His inclination and his political outlook is that holds that society should be diverse, and yet his findings showed that the more diverse societies are, the weaker they are, the less communitarian, the lower the level of social trust. In fact, he was publicly bemoaning the fact that the findings were so contrary to what he had hoped they would be. At the very time that American society is becoming more racially, ethnically, religiously diverse, this important study by Putnam shows that these very trends are socially harmful, certainly in the short run, that there's been a pronounced decline in what Putnam calls social capital, that is, the social networks, friendships, religious congregations, neighborhood associations, that he and other social scientists say are key indicators of civic well-being. When social capital is high, Putnam and others say communities are better places to live in. Neighborhoods are safer, people are healthier, and more citizens vote. This study involved residents in 41 U.S. communities, and he asked people how much they trusted their neighbors and those of each racial category. And much to his amazement, he found that the levels of distrust not only increased by people towards other races, but people's level of distrust and suspicion of people of their own race increased the more racially and ethnically diverse a society and a community became. As Putnam concludes, that people in more diverse communities tend to, quote, distrust their neighbors regardless of the color of their skin, to withdraw even from close friends, to expect the worst from their community and its leaders, to volunteer less, give less to charity, and work on community projects less often, to register to vote less, to agitate for social reform more, but have less faith that they can actually make a difference, and to huddle unhappily in front of the television. People in ethnically diverse settings, Putnam writes, appear to, as he put it, hunker down, to pull in like a turtle. Well, we'll take a break at this point and resume again, come back in a few moments with the second half of this broadcast. Hello and welcome back. In this broadcast, I'm talking a lot about the relationship between social inequality and diversity in a society. And I'm citing the studies and the findings of Robert Putnam and others that confirm that the more ethnically and racially diverse a society is, the higher the level of distrust and the higher the level of social pathology in a society. What tends to happen as societies become more racially, ethnically diverse is not that people either reach out to others or engage in fights or conflicts with others. What they tend to do is just withdraw. The result is a general civic malaise. And as I mentioned, perhaps the most surprising result of all is that levels of trust were not only lower between groups in more diverse settings, but even among members of the same group. And these findings run completely counter to the happy talk of our political leaders about the wonders of diversity. Two economists, one at UCLA in California and another at MIT in Massachusetts, reviewed 15 recent studies in a paper published in 2003, all of which linked diversity with lower levels of social capital. That is, greater ethnic diversity were linked, for example, to lower school funding, census response rates, and trust in others. They made the point that during the American Civil War among Union Army soldiers, soldiers tended to desert from their units much more often when the units were more diverse by age, occupation, and birthplace. In other words, the military units that fought best were those that were the most united and cohesive in terms of age, social background, and place of birth. The claim made over and over by our educators and our political leaders that diversity is a great strength is made by people either out of ignorance or out of deceit. Either they know this is untrue or they don't know it and simply ignore the common sense understanding that anybody with life experience should know, or that is based upon the empirical studies and data and findings that have been carried out. One of the remarkable things about the diversity as our strength claim is that this slogan, diversity is our strength, was the slogan of a specific campaign carried out by one of the most prominent Jewish Zionist organizations in America, the so-called Anti-Defamation League. This powerful organization boasted in its newsletter about how they had launched and been very successful in promoting this slogan, diversity is our strength. And in the summer 1997 issue of the bulletin of the Anti-Defamation League entitled On the Frontline, the ADL took pride in the fact that President Bill Clinton had taken what it called the ADL tagline and given it an unexpected boost, saying that diversity is our greatest strength. Now, to me, the claim by the ADL that diversity is our strength is not merely a falsehood, but a lie, a conscious lie. I say that because the Anti-Defamation League promotes this slogan for every society except the one that the ADL is most supportive of, namely Israel. The ADL promotes the slogan, diversity is our strength, in the United States. In fact, not only promotes it, Zionist groups like the ADL insist upon maximum ethnic, racial diversity in not only the United States, but also in Canada, in Britain, Germany, France, Russia, and other countries, but at the same time insist that not diversity, but social, ethnic, religious cohesion is the greatest strength in Israel. In fact, Zionist organizations like the Anti-Defamation League insist that the United States must support and guarantee the security of Israel, not only as a country or as a society, but as a specific Jewish ethnic religious state and society. That's a demand that is made by that is demanded of the United States of no other society in the world. Nobody says that the United States should guarantee that Ireland remains a white or Christian country. Nobody in Ireland or in any other country says the United States should give a pledge like that to Canada or Japan or Germany or any other country. But Zionist organizations insist that the preservation and the protection of Israel as a specifically Jewish ethnic religious society is a priority, or should be a priority, for the United States, while it's at the same time demanding, insisting on precisely the opposite for American society. To me, this level of blatant hypocrisy is proof that when organizations like the ADL talk about diversity as a strength, they're insincere about this, because they know that it can't possibly be a strength if it doesn't apply to the country they care a great deal about. In fact, if the history of the 20th century shows anything, it's the inherent instability and weakness of ethnically, religiously, culturally diverse societies. In our lifetimes, we've seen the breakup of the Soviet Union, for example, which was proclaimed and held up as a model social, ethnic, cultural, diverse society, and it broke apart precisely along the lines of the different ethnic groups. But even more than that, or even perhaps more to the point, even a country as relatively similar as Czechoslovakia, that is made up of two important ethnic groups, the Czechs and the Slovaks, broke into separate countries, the Czech Republic and Slovakia, because understandably and historically, perfectly understandably, Czechs and Slovaks, like many other people, prefer to live in a country of their own culture and their own people, and to have the leadership of the country be people of their own kind. This is perfectly understandable. And the promotion of diversity of our greatest strength, or as our strength, as American leaders like to tell us, flies in the face of the experiences of the Soviet Union, of the Czechoslovakia, and also, for example, of Yugoslavia, which also broke apart along ethnic cultural lines and formed into different national states. The economic and social difficulties that the United States is going through right now are very difficult for many Americans to fully grasp or appreciate, because for many years the United States really was number one in the world in many ways. Especially in the years after World War II, from 1946, 47, 48, right after World War II, up until about 1980, the United States was on top of the world, so to speak. It was number one. Much of the reason for this is not because, as our political leaders like to say or imply, that Americans were wiser or better or morally superior to other countries, but because in the aftermath of World War II, the United States emerged as the only industrial power that hadn't been destroyed in the war. In 1948, for example, something like 80% of the automobiles of the world were produced by the big three automobile companies of Detroit: General Motors, Ford, and Chrysler. But that's changed now drastically. Today, more automobiles are produced in China than in the United States and Japan combined. The to other major automobile-producing countries in the world. Today, the claim by the United States or by many Americans that this is the U.S. is still number one is still a slogan that many people embrace or want to embrace out of pride, but it's harder and harder to uphold that. It's true that the U.S. is still the number one economy in the world, although most economists predict that within the next 10 or 20 years, China is very likely to overcome the United States in that regard. The United States is also still the number one military power in the world. By far, its military is more powerful than that of any other country or any other combination of countries, any realistic combination of countries. And the U.S. is still preeminent in the world in cultural life. American motion pictures are still dominant in the world. But in many other ways, the United States is no longer number one, except now increasingly in a lot of areas that one does not take pride in. The U.S., for example, is number one in the incarceration and prison population. It has by far the largest prison population in the entire globe. It has the highest percentage of obese, overweight people in the world. By a wide margin, it has the highest divorce rate in the world. It's tied with Britain for the most hours of television watched per person per week. It has the highest rate of illegal drug use in the planet. There are more car thefts in the United States each year than anywhere else in the world by far. There are more reported rapes in the United States each year than anywhere else in the world. However, that's reported rapes. It may very well be that the rape rate is higher in South Africa. But among so-called advanced or in countries of the world, the rate of rape in the U.S. is by far the largest. Moreover, the rate of murder in the United States each year is larger than anywhere else in the world per capita. And overall, there are more total crimes in the United States than anywhere else in the world. The U.S. has more police officers than anywhere else. And it spends more on health care as a percentage of gross domestic product than any other country in the world. The percentage of women taking antidepressants in the United States is higher than any other country in the world. The U.S. has the largest trade deficit in the world. The U.S. also has by far much more spending on the military than any other country in the world. In fact, U.S. military spending is greater than the military spending of China, Russia, Japan, India, and the rest of European NATO countries combined. It has more, far more, military bases around the world than anywhere else in the world. And the United States has accumulated the largest national debt that the world has ever seen. In fact, within the space of about 40 years, the United States has gone from being the number one creditor country in the world to being the number one debtor country in the world. Earlier on, I was speaking about this book, The Spirit Level, by the authors Wilkinson and Pickett, that talked about the relationship between equality in a society and levels of prosperity, well-being, low levels of crime, and so forth. But one of the points that the authors of the book do not make as explicit and as pointedly as I think they should make are two startling and striking and I think crucial facts about the countries they cite as the most exemplary, the most model societies in that regard. Every one of the countries they mention that at the top of the indexes of successful societies are all characterized by two things, by a high level of homogeneity, of social, of ethnic, cultural cohesion and homogeneity. Countries like Japan, Sweden, Denmark, so forth, are all countries which are overwhelmingly of one particular ethnic group. Now, there are some changes in that. For example, in Sweden, there's been a big increase in third world migration in recent years. And as one might expect, or one shouldn't be surprised to note, that the crime rate among the immigrants is far higher than among the native population of Sweden. The other thing that's characteristic of these countries is they have a high level of average intelligence, or IQ level. And this brings me to another very important study and research that's been carried out, especially by two very important social scientists, Richard Lynn and Tatu Vanhanen. Richard Lynn is a professor in Northern Ireland, and Tatu Vanhanen is a Finnish political scientist. These two men are the authors of two important books which lay out very carefully and very irrefutably, I think, the relationship between the level of intelligence, of average IQ, and the level of prosperity in a society. The two books that they wrote are, one, IQ and the Wealth of Nations, which was published in the year 2002, and a follow-up book entitled IQ and Global Inequality, published in 2006. The findings of these two social scientists, which is based on a tremendous amount of empirical data, data that's been accumulating at a rapid rate in recent years, and which I think is now really irrefutable, shows that IQ, the average intelligence level as measured in IQ tests, is very highly correlated with per capita income and rates of economic development. The authors argued that this could be predicted because intelligence is correlated with earnings among individuals, and nations are aggregates of individuals, so that the same correlation would be expected across nations. Now, this is a very bold and, for many people, a very unsettling claim, because the causes of national differences in wealth are one of the major problems of economics, in which many hundreds of books and much study has been devoted over the years. Over time, many important sociologists, historians, psychologists, and social scientists have struggled with the question, why are some countries better off than others? Why are some societies more prosperous, more orderly, less crime-ridden, more technologically advanced than others? And Lynn and Vanhanen, I think, have assembled data that shows conclusively that intelligence, the average level of intelligence, is a decisive predictor of the level of economic prosperity within society. They point out that for many, many years, economists have simply disregarded intelligence levels in society. They either just simply assumed that all peoples in the world have the same average level of intelligence, or they didn't even consider it one way or the other. The assumption by many economists and historians and others that the average level of intelligence is the same in all nations is, as Lynn and Vanhanen shows, a seriously wrong one. To the contrary, there are enormous national differences in intelligence that range between an average of 67 or 70 in sub-Saharan Africa to 105, that is above average, in the so-called Asian tiger economies of the Pacific Rim, such as East China, Hong Kong, Korea, Japan, and so forth. Now, like many important discoveries in science, it may seem in retrospect obvious that these national differences in intelligence must inevitably determine differences in economic development. And a few minutes of thought ought to show that it seems astonishing that this has not been, this theory has not been really seriously advanced until now, until recent years. And it's also understandable, too, that because the findings of Lynn and Van Hannon fly in the face of the prevailing ideological assumptions of our society, that their findings would be criticized. But they're able to assemble this information because it's only in recent years that extensive testing and data to show the levels of intelligence in different countries has been able to be put together. And as I mentioned, the second of the two books, entitled IQ and Global Inequality, is an expansion of and builds upon the first book. Above all, Lynn and Van Hannon present much more data to strengthen and support their conclusions about the relationship between intelligence and prosperity. But they also do something else in this new book. They address the question of the causes of national differences and in intelligence. And they conclude that this lies in the racial composition of the population. That is, that IQ is related, is largely hereditary. Now, this has, of course, again, caused tremendous amounts of discussion and controversy, and they've been attacked for this conclusion. But it helps explain not only the differences in prosperity and social order and stability in societies around the world, but the differences even within the same country. Why it is that even within the old Soviet Union, for example, there were notable differences in social well-being and prosperity, even within the Soviet Union, say, the Northern European, Baltic societies and countries of Estonia and Latvia on the one hand, and the Central Asian countries of Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan, Kyrgyzstan, and so forth, in the southern central part of the Soviet Union on the other hand. As Lynn and Van Hannon show, the six East Asian nations of China, Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, Hong Kong, and Singapore all have IQs in the ranges between, range between 105 and 108. That is, above average compared to the average of 100. And the 29 European nations all have IQs in the range between 92 and 102. That is, the average. While the 19 nations of sub-Saharan Africa, which are also the by far the poorest societies in the world, all have IQs in the range between about 60 and 75, far below the average IQ of European nations. And again, there's a close correlation, as they show, between societies with a high average IQ and social ethnic cohesion and homogeneity. In this book, a new book by Lynn and Van Hannon, the one published in 2006, they convincingly refute those critics who assert that their national IQ data lacks reliability and validity. And they've made a discovery. They have published findings with the very important implications for all of us. Because if their findings are correct, and I think the data does show that, this means that the trajectory of the United States in recent years and the trends of the country that are supported by the political leaders are inevitably going to mean more and more social dislocation, more and more social economic problems in the United States in the years ahead. As uncomfortable as these findings are, and as unsettling as they might be for many people, political programs and policies, if they're going to be effective, have to be based on reality and fact and not upon wishful thinking. Well, that concludes this Mark Weber Report broadcast. I hope you'll join me for the next Mark Weber Report.